Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey guys, welcome back. I want to thank all of you again for being here and for listening. And, you know, it's fun. I can actually look. I know where everyone is. Like, I know where listeners are. Audio Boom actually divides it up by country and then by city. So I know where I'm getting listeners. And I know last week we talked about, I said everyone, you know, just kind of bring in somebody special. But tonight I just want to focus on Iceland. We have 8 listeners in Iceland. And, you know, here's what I want to do. And I'm just talking to Iceland now. You Iceland guys, there's 8 of you. If you could just each, I want each of you to get one other person. Okay? Just you guys. Because then I'll know. It'll go to 16. So could you guys do that? Just in Iceland. I'm just talking to Iceland right now. If you guys could just get one, each one of you get one extra person. And we'll see if we can kind of, you could leapfrog right over Albania. And I'm not, listen, I'm going to get around to all of you, okay? I'm looking at you, Sri Lanka. I want to start at the bottom and sort of work my way up. So let's see if we can't do that, okay? All right, I'll be watching. Guys, I hope you like tonight's show. I will hopefully hear from you on social media. And here we go. Dancing Past the Dark, Distressing Near-Death Experiences by Nancy Evans Bush. I've read a lot of books about near-death experiences, but I've never read anything like Nancy Evans Bush's Dancing Past the Dark. In the writer's room, we have a rule. We never use the word problem. We don't want to bring the room down and hurt anyone's feelings. We use the word challenge, as in, well, the challenge with your character is that he's a moron. Or, well, you know what your challenge is? Your story doesn't make any fucking sense. So let me be clear. When I started to read this book, I had a real challenge with it. Am I telling you not to read this book? No, I am telling you, you have to read this book. You have to eat your vegetables. Look, it's all well and good to curl up in front of the fireplace and read about the Enfield Poltergeist or the Borley Rectory. We've all been there. It's fun to read ghost stories and guides to the haunted bed and breakfasts of New England, but what are we really doing? We're trying to figure out if there's something more. And if I'm honest, and I am, I will tell you that when I read the books on my paranormal bookshelf, I'm testing each one to see if there is a reason to suspect that our physical life may not be the end of the story. Dancing Past the Dark reassures us on one level. There is something more. The problem? I'm sorry, the challenge? The challenge is, it's a fucking nightmare. First, just in case you're somehow not familiar, let's talk about the near-death experience in general. As defined in the Handbook of Near-Death Studies, 2009, Prager Publishers, a near-death experience, or as we'll call it from here on out, an NDE, is, quote, an unusual, often vivid and realistic, and sometimes profoundly life-changing experience occurring to people who have been physiologically close to death, as in cardiac arrest, or psychologically close to death, as in accidents or illnesses, in which they feared they would die. End quote. Let's drop anchor here for just a second. I'm not going to spend a lot of time today arguing the reality of NDEs or picking apart skeptical arguments. But I am going to reiterate, NDEs happen when people are physically, clinically dead, but they also happen when a person is not physically compromised at all, but they are afraid they're going to die. Why would this be so? I have a theory, and I'll get to it someday, but this pretty much kills all of these skeptical dying brain theories you might have heard about. NDEs also have a rough template that can include such features as separating from the physical body, traveling through a tunnel toward a bright light, meeting dead relatives or other spiritual beings, a life review, a boundary that cannot be crossed, and either a choice or a command to return to earthly life. Okay, so now that we know what an NDE is, chances are, if you've heard anything about them, you've heard that they're absolutely wonderful and blissful. The reason you've heard this is because many people who report NDEs describe their experience in that way. They report feelings of peace and an all-encompassing love. Sounds amazing. In many ways, the most remarkable feature of an NDE is how it affects the person after it's over. Those who have had what we'll call pleasant NDEs report an enduring sense of peace and love, a diminished fear of death, and in many cases, loss of interest in material wealth and a greater interest in helping others. And these feelings don't fade. They last for years, decades, forever. The reason for this seems to be that the experience makes people feel like a greater reality has been revealed to them. A curtain has been drawn back to show a larger world they were unaware of before. Now they know something about the true nature of the universe, the way things really are. This all sounds great. Of all the supernatural stuff that could happen to me, ghosts, UFOs, Bigfoot, I'd vastly prefer an NDE. Who wouldn't want to live the rest of their life without a fear of death, and with a certainty that what awaits us on the other side of the grave is an eternity of all-encompassing love? Am I right? Are you sitting down? Not all NDEs are like that. Some of them are a challenge. A big challenge. Back in the 1960s, before the term even existed, Nancy Evans Bush had a near-death experience. Even though back then no one really talked about them or had a name for them, she knew what was happening. She was dying. And she was getting a preview of what her own personal eternity was going to be. The experience was extremely real, extremely convincing, and extremely terrifying. She's been grappling with the after effects for more than 60 years. Nancy was in the process of giving birth to her second child. It was an emergency induction. She was anesthetized and lost consciousness. But then suddenly she was conscious and completely alert and flying over the roof of the hospital. She can see the town below her just like she's in a helicopter or a hot air balloon. Then she goes higher. She can see the curvature of the earth at the horizon. Then she goes higher, into outer space, in her words, like an astronaut without a capsule. She is now simply floating in a featureless twilight. Then the circles show up. Six of them, off to her left, moving toward her. Half black, half white, and clicking as they move, snapping, white to black, black to white, sending a message without words, and the message is clear. This is all there is. This is all there ever was. This is it. Anything else you remember is a joke. You are not real. You never were real. You never existed. Your life never existed. The world never existed. It was a game you were allowed to invent. There was never anything or anyone. That's the joke. That it was all a joke. Nancy remembers arguing with the circles, tossing out facts about her life, details, small and large, but all of them real. The circles answered back, "Whatever you remember is part of the joke. Your mother, your babies, they were never real. This is all there is, all there ever was, just this." Then the circles drift away, leaving her utterly alone in the darkness, with the overwhelming knowledge that nothing she had ever experienced on Earth was real or had meaning and never would. Her grief was excruciating, and when she woke up in the hospital, this crushing revelation surrounded her. She knew a terrible secret about the true nature of reality. Everything she had been taught about God was a lie, and now she knew exactly what was waiting for her when she died. It's been 60 years. She still knows it. It's like it happened yesterday. That's the most compelling thing about NDEs. They stay with people for so long because somehow They feel more real than every other moment of your life. It's one thing to be depressed and feel like the world is meaningless and nothing matters. It's another to have a spiritual experience confirm it as cosmic fact. This wasn't something she could share with anyone, not even her husband. How could she? How could she tell someone she loved that the truth of existence is that everything is a meaningless illusion, a sick joke engineered by some uncaring, non-human, universal force? She knew this to be true. This became the central emotional truth of her life. And that truth was, we're fucked. Life's a bitch, and then you die, and that's when things get really bad. Nancy didn't speak of her experience for 20 years. Then one day she answered an ad for temporary work in the offices of a new nonprofit starting up near her home, something called the International Association for Near-Death Studies. Nancy has now worked with IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, for the past 40 years, serving in almost every capacity up to and including executive director, president, and member of the board of directors. Spending decades working alongside Bruce Grayson and Kenneth Ring, two early NDE researchers, Nancy has been able to navigate the onslaught of pleasant NDE reports and still hold the door open for the kind almost no one ever dares talk about. The kind that happened to her. The first time I read this book, I was in Toronto. I pronounce it Toronto because I was told that's how people in Toronto say it. So the first time I read this book, I was in Toronto, which was my first mistake. Not being in Toronto, that was fine. But I was going to be away from my home and family for about a month. So maybe bringing along a book about having your soul plunged into an eternal hell dimension wasn't the smartest move. It was January 2018, and my first time on set for Titans. January is a tough month for me in general. Christmas is over, and the existential threat of a new year looms high. What potentially horrific things will come my way in the next 12 months that I couldn't possibly anticipate right now? I am getting better about that, but let's just say that for the first half of January, it's definitely the 5 a.m. of the new year for me. I'm just not ready to get out of bed yet. But this year, I didn't have a choice. My ass was on an early flight to Canada on January 2nd. I sat in business class and washed down a Xanax with a Bloody Mary and secretly spied on Minka Kelly and Alan Richson, who sat a few rows ahead of me but had no idea who I was yet, which was just the way I liked it. By the way, we all eventually did meet and had a great time on Titans. They're awesome people. Go Reacher. The Titans episode I was covering is special in my mind and heart because A, it was my first, and B, it was one of our two lost episodes that never aired in their entirety. And C, Toronto was cold as fuck. Like, historically cold. Even the Canadians were scared. And, like a typical LA boy, I thought it was all an exciting lark until I didn't anymore. One morning I thought it'd be fun to walk half a mile to a diner for breakfast, but the air was so insanely chemically cold, I lost the ability to form rational thoughts every 50 feet or so, and had to keep ducking into bookstores and donut shops to gather myself before pushing on. The hotel for visiting American TV people is the Soho Metropolitan on Wellington, just down from Blue Jay Stadium and the CN Tower. My room overlooked Clarence Square Park, where all the downtown dwellers bring their dogs to play and poop every hour of the day and night. And just around the corner was a very cozy, quiet bar called Corvo, the Italian word for raven, which of course felt perfect for all of us on Titans. Corvo became my place. I'd trudge up the stairs at midnight after shooting all day and collapse into a soft booth and drink a cocktail invented by Olivia, the bartender who was always there and spent her days experimenting with alcohol and then trying out her creations on me. We'd chat for a bit, then I'd take out my book, Dancing Past the Dark, and she would gather all the candles from the empty tables and put them all on my table so I could see the words better. They had a kitchen too, so most nights I'd have pork ragu pasta or an onion and sausage pizza before finally heading back out into the freezing night for the walk back to my hotel. Within days, the city felt like home. On set, Titans was the smoothest production I'd ever seen. I met the brilliant Anna Diop, who played Starfire, and for 5 years, I never stopped being blown away by how effortlessly she nailed every scene. One of my most vivid memories was on the last day of the shoot. I was way outside Toronto in a place called Brougham Pickering. I don't know what this place usually looks like, but that day it looked like the dark side of the North Pole. A featureless expanse of white. Gray clouds hung low in the sky, and it snowed constantly. All we had to do was film a complicated car stunt and two long dialogue scenes in the sub-freezing air, and we had a whole 8 hours, from sunrise to sunset, to do it. The cameras had to literally be wrapped in plastic just to keep them from freezing. Anna stayed inside a warm van until we were just ready to call action, and then she'd emerge in the skimpy violet dress she wore for most of the first season. Now keep in mind, the rest of us are standing around in ski masks and parkas. We'd shoot as fast as we could, which wasn't very fast, and all I could think of during every take was, how is Anna getting her words out, much less acting? The second our director Grant Harvey called cut, we'd wrap a coat around her and get her back into the van to thaw out. After the third take, I jogged over to her as she made her way back to the van, and I asked her if she was okay. She said she was, but it seemed impossible for any human being to do what she was doing. "Are you sure?" I asked. She smiled at me and said, "I'm fine. I'm Starfire." And then she stuck out her hands and pretended to shoot flames at me. Sometimes you get lucky. The next morning, I packed up all my things, said goodbye to my view of the dog park and Corvo, caught a flight back to Los Angeles, and fell into one of the deepest depressions of my life. It took Nancy and Ian's 9 years to find 50 people willing to talk about their distressing near-death experiences. 9 years. This is out of thousands of reports of the pleasant kind. The 50 people who had the challenging kind included laborers, professionals, high school dropouts, PhDs, students, the unemployed, people who identified as Jewish, Christian, agnostic, and atheist. In other words, the distressing NDEs seemed to come from the same cross-section of people who reported pleasant NDEs. The basic finding was that there were three distinct types of distressing NDEs. The most common type shared elements of the traditional pleasant NDEs, but the stages were experienced as terrifying. The second type featured elements that correspond to the hell of popular imagination, but surprisingly, this type was actually the least common. The third type was what Nancy had, an experience of nothingness, of being without sensation and existing in a limitless, featureless, godless void. Why did it take so long for so few stories to come their way? Well, it's because this was taboo on top of taboo. Half the people out there don't even believe in NDEs, and those that do only want to hear about the good ones. Plus, there's an implied judgment. Maybe people who have bad NDEs deserved them. Maybe all those stories we grew up with about sinners being punished are true. Nancy points out that there is no research to back up any claims about experiencers deserving the NDE they got, good or bad. Criminals and murderers have good NDEs. Devout Christians and really nice atheists have bad ones. Previous belief systems have no bearing on who has an NDE or what that NDE will feel like. Well, you say maybe the people who have bad NDEs are psychologically screwed up. Nope, data does not support it. Well, you say maybe they're feeling negative feelings right before their NDEs. Really? You think? Like while they're drowning or getting shot or having a heart attack or a car accident or attempting suicide? Wouldn't that seem to imply that the vast majority of NDEs would be distressing? But they're not. Look, the only thing we know consistently about people who have distressing NDEs is that they don't like talking about them. And who can blame them? This, of course, makes things worse in a way. Deep down, we all want to believe that we're good, and that if there's an afterlife, we'll be okay. Undeserved suffering is the worst part of our physical lives. Shouldn't things get a little easier on the other side? So many books I've read and so many of the messages we've all heard through mediums suggest that life after death is extremely forgiving, and that no matter how badly you screwed up on Earth, it's all about learning from your mortal mistakes and moving forward in an evolution of the soul that never ends. So what are we supposed to think when some people, good people, come back with a very different story? My depression upon returning home crept up on me, and like it often does, it didn't announce itself. In fact, as they say, I was the last to know. One of the first things I did when I got back was go see my dad. He still lived in the house I grew up in, only now, instead of smelling like my mom's powder, it smelled like roast beef and stewed carrots and cleaning supplies, because Champagne had moved in. Champagne was my dad's caregiver, a loud, loving, life-giving woman from Haiti who pulled my dad back from the brink of death when she came into our lives a few years before. She'd say, "I told God you can't have John yet." My dad, named John, just like my brother, had lung problems, and Champagne insisted the only thing for it was an onion soaked in sugar water and sat out in the sun for about 8 hours. My brother and I weren't sure about this, but then we thought, what can it hurt? It's just an onion. Before Champagne, my dad lived on 3 Klondike bars a day, plus whatever food he'd allow us to bring over, mostly burritos and tacos from local places. It'd take him all week to work his way through a burrito, but he'd plow through 3 Klondike bars like he was training for the diabetes decathlon. And he wouldn't listen to a word we said about anything. That all changed when Champagne showed up. She did what we couldn't. Cook him healthy meals and then stand over him and yell at him until he ate them. And he fought her. And he hated us for bringing someone to live in his house. And my brother felt bad about it. And I felt less bad. But after a few months, the shouting stopped. And a few months after that, we saw my dad put on weight. So, apparently we weren't terrible sons after all. Maybe. Now that was when my dad was 85. Now my dad was nearing his 88th birthday. He used a walker inside the house and a wheelchair to get to and from the car. He struggled with mild dementia. Mostly he had trouble remembering when events happened in the past. For example, I'd been in Toronto almost a month, but when I saw him, he thought I'd only been gone a couple days. After not seeing him for so long, I was really struck by how much older he seemed. It was upsetting. He seemed barely able to talk to me. Champagne told me that he slept a lot and his energy was low. I could feel it. He was winding down. I checked in with my brother John, who saw him almost every day. Had he noticed the same thing? He said he hadn't, which drove me nuts. When I got home, I told Susan about my conversation with my brother. "He acts like Dad has the flu or something and we gotta get him better. But he's not ever going to get better. He's only going to get worse. But John refuses to see it because he doesn't want to. He's in complete denial." Susan said she thought I was the one in denial. "What are you talking about? I'm the only one who can see how much worse he's getting." Susan said, "That's because you see him a lot less. You've been gone for a month. John's there every day." Which, of course, felt like a judgment and a cheap shot made me defensive. "Whatever," I said. "I think we need to get him to the doctor. I'm making him an appointment right now. There, see? I'm proactive. Back in town one day, and I'm already solving problems, making doctor's appointments. I'm producing the shit out of my dad's health. That's what I do. Boom. Produce in Toronto. Produce down here. Both sides of the border. Yeah. Now I felt better. I'm the good one. I'm the good one. I'm the good one." Susan and I didn't really fight that night, but there was stress, a rumble in the background of all of our interactions. We were on the edge of something. Later, in bed, I was reading the Bad NDE book when Susan said, "Are you okay?" I said, "I'm fine. Why?" But I kind of snapped it at her. She said, "Because you're whispering again," which is something I do, usually while driving. What I'm actually doing is having an argument. I'm rehearsing what I'd say to whoever it is I'm having my imaginary argument with. Usually it's skeptics or somebody on Twitter. These imaginary arguments never make me feel better. I put the book down. I think maybe I don't believe in NDEs. "Oh no," Susan said. "What's an NDE?" Can you believe I married this person? I told her about the book and Nancy Bush's negative NDE and how weird it was and how unlike other NDEs it was and how maybe these really were all just hallucinations and maybe it meant there was no life after death. I was embarrassed to say this. I felt like a coward, abandoning my beliefs because now my beliefs felt scary. "Well," she said, "if the book is upsetting to you, maybe you should stop reading it." Duh, yeah, sure. I tried to explain to her that that would be cheating. I tried to explain that I read these books to figure out the truth, and if I just stopped reading the ones that made me feel bad, it would be intellectually dishonest. "Why is it so important?" Susan asked. "Because I'm trying to figure this all out. God, it's like she was put on this earth to torture me. If this book is true, it means maybe you or me or our kids might die and be in a really bad place forever." "Well," she said, "what if it's not true?" "It probably is true," I said. "I think it's true." Then she said something really weird. "You know what?" she said. "You're allowed to feel any way you want to feel about your books. You can agree or disagree or just add it to the pile. I've seen your bookshelf. Even worse, I've seen your wish list. There's always going to be another book." She had a point. A lot of my books I'd read more than once and had very different feelings about them each time. Some books sort of canceled other books out. Some added to them, refined them. Maybe I didn't have to decide one way or the other about Dancing Past the Dark. Maybe she was giving me permission to stop reading it. I put the book on the nightstand and clicked off my light. Susan rubbed my arm. You want to do something? I smiled at her. Yeah. So we watched an episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show and went to sleep. 3 weeks later, I was back in Toronto and feeling good. This time with Jeff Thomas. We'd co-written the Jason Todd episode. I won't go into the plot except to say that it introduces one of the coolest characters we had on the show, and it was played by Curran Walters as if he'd been born to play it. Toronto was even better this time, if that was possible. Jeff and I hung out during prep, we drank and had dinner, and even went to see Bruce McCullough from Kids in the Hall do a one-man show, which was pretty much my entire Toronto bucket list. And we got to work with the amazing director Carol Banker, who became our producer-director for season 2 and 3. The whole thing played out like a dream. Then, once we started shooting, Brian Edward Hill showed up to prep his episode, and everything went up a notch. We all went to Corvo together one night. This time it was early, around 9:30, and it was packed. And I got to do something I'd only ever seen on television. I got to walk into a warm, crowded bar, mid-conversation with my friends, and continue talking as I took off my hat and overcoat and scarf and hung them all up on a crowded coat rack. I glanced over and waved at Olivia behind the bar, and she smiled and waved back like she was expecting us, and she pointed to an empty table, and we walked right over and sat down like we owned the place. The whole time, Brian and Jeff and I were talking and laughing about something, I don't even remember what, but I remember being inside and outside myself in this moment. I've never had a place where I could just walk in the middle of a crowd and be welcomed like family. I don't know why this simple moment stays with me, but it's this moment I connect with that trip, and it was the best moment I had. I didn't bring Dancing Past the Dark with me this time to Toronto. In fact, ever since the conversation with Susan, I hadn't picked up the book at all. Why torture myself? Life's hard enough as it is. I had decided for my own health to try to focus on the positive and surround myself with things that made me happy. I brought my DVD set of The Mary Tyler Moore Show with me, and I watched an episode or two in my hotel room every night before bed. And it worked. When I was in Toronto, I was happy. Then I went home and got depressed again. And worse, I got angry. I didn't know I was angry. I thought I felt good, energized. I was on fire in the writer's room. We were closing in on the end of the season, and we were coming up with really great stuff. I felt creatively fulfilled. I was earning a steady paycheck. I felt powerful, confident, bold, decisive. But there was a dark energy beneath the surface, an impatience with anything that seemed to want to slow me down. I didn't want to slow down. I wanted to move unimpeded through my life and accomplish things. But I also had to sleep. And that's where the challenges came in. I had to cede control of my mind and body. It took me a long time to fall asleep, and I couldn't stop thinking about how much trying to fall asleep felt like losing control. It felt like weakness. It felt like dying. I don't remember having nightmares, but I'd wake up every morning scared to death, just shrouded in feelings of doom. Then, on my drive to work, the fear would go away, and I'd start to get angry. I'd whisper. I'd have my imaginary fights with people. Brian Hill has a saying, "Anger is just fear in a little black dress." But I didn't associate his words with myself. The fear wasn't me. The anger was a little bit me. The guy at Titans getting praised and handed script assignments, that was me. Things were going way too good to feel bad. And I was planning to go see my dad. I really was. I just kept putting it off. The building where we wrote Titans is in Burbank. It's a low-slung, retro-looking three-story affair that used to be the NBC network headquarters. But in 2018, it housed the writing staffs of almost all the shows that Greg Berlanti produced. Titans was on the third floor, just down the hall from Supergirl and Riverdale. Downstairs was Arrow, The Flash, and Black Lightning. We had a giant Halloween party the previous October with the staffs of all the shows up in our offices. And then Black Lightning did the Christmas party, and they were epic. I loved that after 25 years of being a professional writer and 17 years in television, I finally felt like I was part of something, a group or a team or a family. It was like being in college, if I'd gone to college. I didn't. I went to USC. The Berlanti building also happened to be two blocks from St. Joseph's Hospital, where I was born. And that was also where my doctor had his offices and where we were now taking my dad. So at lunch that day, I just walked down to the hospital and met up with my dad in Champaign. I thought I was on time, but it turns out they'd already met with Dr. Marsh. He asked to see me privately. Once the door was closed, he said, "Your dad needs to go on hospice care." I think I said, "What?" Dr. Marsh said, "Your dad's lung condition can be considered terminal. I know he's been handling it and doing treatments, but it's too much now." Hang on, I said. But then I didn't say anything else. I just needed him to stop talking. Dr. Marsh is great. He's blunt. I love that. But right now it was too much. I honestly didn't understand what he was talking about. He went on. "The stress on your dad just to breathe is what's draining him. Frankly, he shouldn't have even come all the way down here today. Does he leave the house a lot?" "Yeah," I said. "Every Sunday he comes to my house or John's house for breakfast. The whole family sees him, so he's getting exercise." "That's got to stop," he said. "He doesn't need exercise. He's not strong enough." "Not strong enough to come to our houses?" Dr. Marsh said, "Just getting in and out of the car is too much for him. He should be in bed." "All the time," I said. "Yes, and he can get that kind of care if he's in hospice. You can have a hospital bed delivered to your house, and it's all paid for through Medicare. Anything you're paying for now, once he's officially on hospice, it's covered." Well, my dad did love a bargain, but I could feel myself getting upset. The anger was coming in. How's he going to get better if he's in bed all the time? Great, now I sound like my brother. Dr. Marsh smiled at me again. He's not going to get better. He's 88, and he has a terminal lung condition. But he can get more comfortable. The hospital bed was delivered to the house later that week and set up in the family room. This room was where my brother and I would spend our summers, glued to the television all day. I Love Lucy at 9 a.m., The Twilight Zone for lunch at noon, then Barney Miller at 3, and The Rockford Files at 3:30, and then The Bob Newhart Show at 4:30, and all the way until 6 p.m. when Night Gallery came on and scared the shit out of us. Champagne got my dad set up in the new bed, but now the television played sports and news and played it way too loud, and once he was in that bed, my dad never got out again. Nancy and the other researchers at IONS had done all they could with the people they'd found who were willing to talk, but now what? She thought about her own experience. The clicking circles, black and white, mocking her and telling her with strange confidence that everything was just an illusion and that life had no meaning. And she remembered the day she found out what the circles really were. Years ago, before she'd ever heard of IONS, before it even existed, she'd been in the home of a friend who had just purchased a copy of Carl Jung's Man and His Symbols. She started glancing through it, and right there staring back at her were the circles. In her words, quote, "Someone else knew about the circles." My breath jammed in my throat, and in a storm of terror, I hurled the book across the room and fled from the house, too frightened to even say goodbye. The image from which I fled, the circle, whose message I had been repressing for years, was foreign, terrifying, and meaningless, except as recalled from my own experience. I did not recognize it. It would be several more years before I discovered that it was the yin-yang, the ancient Chinese symbol, of the seemingly opposed but always interdependent principles within all of human experience. The balance of yes-no. Male-female, active-passive, light-dark, life-death, moving in a constant flow of interactions. It is the interconnection of opposites, the acceptance of ambiguity and paradox, the understanding that reality is both less than what we believe it to be and more. How does an unrecognized ancient Chinese symbol become a message bearer in the experience of a mainstream Protestant in New England like me? It took years, decades really, but this symbol unlocks a path for Nancy, a way to approach thinking about her NDE. In a way, it helped the NDE feel less personal. These are my words, not hers, and more universal. The symbols one encounters in both positive and negative NDEs share a lot with dream imagery and the collective unconscious. Bridges, tunnels, beings of light, beings of darkness, yin and yang. You can't have one without the other. Nothing is all good, nothing is all bad. For most people, finding integration is the key to happiness, or at least a sense of self that isn't constantly in turmoil, trying to feel only good feelings and forever banishing the bad. And as she points out, there are numerous stories of saints and other religious icons enduring the agony of hellish spiritual encounters. The hero's journey also requires a descent into dark realms that resolves in a later reemergence into light, with the hero reborn and forever changed. Nancy begins to see her distressing NDE as a moment in a larger drama, rather than a preview of an eternal state of damnation. Now, you might think this is just wishful thinking. I did. But then she presents a number of reported NDEs that begin negative and then continue into a more positive resolution. In other words, there is speculation that any negative NDE, if allowed to go on long enough, would eventually resolve into something less threatening. Of course, all of these discussions and realizations come in the second half of the book, the half I didn't read, because I got too demoralized in the first half and then stopped. Nancy was well on her way to contextualizing what had happened to her. She was facing the darkness. Maybe she wasn't dancing past it. She was dancing with it. This was integration, and I should have known better. I'd been in therapy for many years, and my therapist even now kept placing my trauma in front of me, no matter which way I turned. Work is going great, so why do I feel like shit? Your father is dying. Yeah, I know, but why am I scared and angry all the time? Because your father is dying, and you're repressing your feelings of grief. Okay, right, sure. By the way, I won't be here next week. I'm going back to Toronto. It was now late May, and I was back in Toronto for my final episode of the year. Winter had fled, and in the course of a month, the snow had all melted and summer had arrived. Brenton Thwaites, who played Dick Grayson, was floating in a swimming pool. We were doing a shot that would have been impossible a few weeks earlier. It would have been too cold. But today it was 85 degrees, and the crew was blasting music between takes, and the whole set had a last week of school, summer is coming feeling. But I wasn't feeling it. My agent had just called. Warner Brothers loved the show, but it wasn't going to premiere for months, and they couldn't tell us when the season 2 writer's room would start up again. As a favor, they agreed to let all the writers out of their contracts. We were free to find other work, which was technically good, but emotionally bad. This was a show I wanted to stay on, and now it looked like that wasn't going to happen. The one thing that made me feel good was now slipping away. It was later that week when Forrest Burgess sent me a link to Michael Shermer's website and a blog entry called Frequent Infrequencies. Michael Shermer is a famous skeptic, so this text was, of course, an aggressive attack. Why are you sending me some Michael Shermer shit? I texted back to Forrest. Read it, he replied. Our skeptical friend has gone positively woo-woo. The esteemed M. Shermer has had an honest-to-non-existent God paranormal event, and he's been foolish enough to write about it. Fine, I said, I'd check it out. But I gotta tell you, for me, reading Michael Shermer is like lowering myself into cold sewage. I really, really, really didn't want to do it. I'd had a hard enough time with Nancy Bush's book, and I put that down months ago. Why would I willingly engage with whatever this is? Because Forrest told me to, that's why. Damn you, Forrest Burgess! I won't relate Michael Shermer's whole story here. It has to do with his wedding day, and a broken transistor radio suddenly coming to life at a moment where it would have maximum emotional impact on the people present. It's a great story, and as I read it, I felt myself clench. Was he just using this paranormal parable as a setup for a skeptical smackdown? I had to admit, the fact that he was talking about it at all was impressive. And I gotta be honest, I was waiting for the gut punch the whole time. But here's how the essay ended. Quote, "Until such time when science can explain even the most spectacularly unlikely events, what should we do with such stories? Enjoy them. Appreciate their emotional significance. But we do not need to fill in the explanatory gaps with gods or any such preternatural forces. We can't explain everything, and it's always okay to say, I don't know, and leave it at that until a natural explanation presents itself. Until then, revel in the mystery and drink in the unknown. It's where science and wonder meet." Wow. You see what he did there? He did what Nancy Bush did. He figured out a way to defer judgment. Something scary jumped up at him from out of the dark. Something that had the power to challenge his belief system. But instead of spiraling and acting like a jerk and whispering behind the wheel of his car, he found a way to integrate the experience without abandoning his own personal faith. Well done, Michael Shermer. Well done. A few weeks later, I was back home and once again in bed with Susan Lambert. I was toying with the idea of finally finishing Dancing Past the Dark, something I only finally did in these last few weeks preparing for this podcast. But I had other things on my mind. "What's up?" she asked. I told her that I was worried about what was coming next. Titans was such a good experience, and now it looked like it was over forever. my agent was looking for a new show to staff me on. And the idea of plunging into the dark, a new show, a new group of people, all of it out there but unknown to me, had me scared. "Well, what do you want?" she said. I told her, "I want to go somewhere good where the people are kind and supportive. I want some creative freedom, some input. I guess I just want to have fun." Susan said, "If that's what you want, then go find it." I nodded, but I was thinking, I'm not sure it's really up to me. Then she said, "I know you're scared about what's next, but you almost always end up somewhere good, don't you?" Yeah, I thought, I do end up somewhere good. Almost always. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as we head back to 1984 when my brother gives me the scariest cassette tape we've ever heard, and it sets me on a 40-year quest to unravel the mystery behind the ghost of 29 megacycles. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.